essay, and that's followed at 11 by Late Junction. But now at 10 o'clock, our Proms composer portrait, which was recorded earlier this evening. It's presented by Tom Service.
Welcome to the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall at the Royal College of Music for this latest Proms Plus portrait with the company and music of Cornish composer Graham Fitkin. Musicians from the London Sinfonietta Academy Ensemble, young players drawn from conservatoires all over the country, a scheme that's been running for 3 years, will play three works of Graham's. Siosophy for two pianos, four pianists and eight hands. Sinew for six-piece ensemble, the most recent work we'll hear this evening. And to start us off, Hurl for saxophone quartet. Composed in 1996, Hurl is full of the energy and excitement that's typical of Graham Fitkin's music. So please welcome on stage here at the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall to catapult this music into being and to catalyse tonight's concert. Four saxophone players, Amy Green, Rachel Parry-Ridout, Eleanor McMurray and Eloise Marson, to play Graham Fitkin's Hurl.
Thank you.
Graham Fitkins Hurl, four saxophone players from the London Sinfonietta Academy Ensemble, Amy Green, Rachel Parry-Ridout, Eleanor McMurray and Eloise Marson. Graham, look, the music we've just heard, I know you wrote it in Cornwall, 1996,
yes,
you've moved back.
I mean,
it's music that seems removed from what I take to be the pastoral perfection of the place you live in Cornwall. I mean, it's kind of an urban intensity in that music we've just been listening to.
Yeah, I don't think that my moving back to Cornwall, which is where I came from, I don't think that's really affected my music at all, actually. I still work in a room trying to get the notes in the right order, and that's about all there is to it. I suppose other people might think that there's a change. I think the change in my music, which has occurred over the last however many years it is, and there has been one, and you'll probably hear it tonight in these three pieces, is not in any way connected with geographical location.
Well, when you look back at your career, then, what are the most important moments of change, and where do they happen?
I suppose when, I can only speak for myself as a composer, but for me, I take, I work at my music, and then you work at the next piece, and you work at the next piece, and in some of those pieces, you take a big leap forward, into the unknown, as I did with the cello concerto, in fact. And in other pieces, you hone that a little bit more, so you're not taking such a big step, but you might have gone into an area in the previous one, and you think, well, I might just hone that one a little bit further. It doesn't mean it has the same material, but it's just a way of working. That's, for me, the best way of working. I take a big leap, and then a few pieces will come out around that before I leap off somewhere else.
Well, how important was Hurl then? Was Hurl important in that sense? Did it move you on?
Hurl was. I mean, you'll have noticed that there's that sort of Scottish snap. There's a lot of
dida,
yeah, there's a lot of grace notes going ba-da, ba-da, ba-da-da, ba-da-da. And some of those are, I mean, I have to say, those performers are absolutely stunning. I'm just blown away by how good they all are. But there's some of those are notated, so it's actually notated as a proper rhythm on a piece on the page. And sometimes they're just tiny little notes which are just scribbled in just before it as grace notes. And they make the the performance tonight made that distinction very clear, but for me anyway, that there was the tiny little Scottish snap notes which come in and out.
But does that suggest an influence? Because I mean, hearing that music, I mean, reading your biography and thinking about where you come from as a composer, okay, Cornwall, but musically speaking, you might think about The Writer's Spring. I heard maybe there seemed to be even possibly an allusion to the opening bassoon tune in The Writer's Spring and what the soprano saxophone was playing. Steve Reich, the idea of repetition, minimalism, jazz influence is Miles Davis. I mean, are you conscious of putting all these things together when you come to compose, and how important are those things to you?
Well, I'm aware that I've had those influences, certainly. And I don't really separate them out into little files of Miles Davis or whatever. Although you're absolutely right that's there. But having said that, in that particular piece, there was a much more lyrical air than there had been in lots of my work beforehand. So that you get long lines of soprano sax right at the top, just sort of floating across the top of all this other nonsense going on underneath.
It also you compose. Hearing the music, it sounds so intuitive and full of a kind of energy which seems unbounded, you know? And yet, you compose using mathematics and very fixed structures. I mean, how does that work out when you're in the room, wherever you work, confronted with that blank piece of manuscript paper?
Well, I work in three ways. I either work with a piece of paper and a pencil and no sound at all, which is very useful, or I work at a piano, or I use computer technology. And getting the right balance of those three methods of working is quite important to me. I think if there was a period where I suppose, you know, the computer was new and you could get sequences, and I suddenly thought, oh, this is great. And I did one piece which was almost totally just written at the computer. And then I realized, which I'm still pleased with the piece, but I realized that, in fact, computers are great, but they do drive you in one particular place, and you've got to be quite strong to resist that. Whereas actually working without the sound at all, without any distraction, just a piece of paper, is actually quite useful because it frees you up a lot more. Because otherwise, I mean, or even if I'm at the piano, it's very easy to play something at the piano and think, that sounds rather nice. But what's it got to do with a piece of music? And so it's, you know, just the fact that it sounds nice isn't good enough, actually.
The next piece we're going to hear is Siosophy. I think I'm saying that right.
Yeah? Siosophy, absolutely correct.
Was a piece you presented to your teacher at the time, 1986, Louis Andriessen.
Yeah.
What happened? Because he had a fairly strong reaction to it, I think.
Well, I've been studying with Louis for, at that point, probably for 6 months or so.
And this was in The Hague?
In Holland. And we got on very well. And when I was working on this vast tome for five oboes, five clarinets, and... I can't quite remember, but it's thankfully lost. But I've been working at this for quite some time, and then I had a week off, and I went back and I wrote the piece that we're just about to hear, Siosophy, in a week. And I just sort of immersed myself in it and just wrote sort of this big polyphonic sort of, for me at the time, anyway, it was new. It probably isn't new to anybody else, but for me at the time it was new. But so I showed it to Louis. I was really pleased. I said, "Have a look at this. This is what I really want to do." And he had a look at it. And he said, "Yeah, it's all right. Yeah, it's okay." And then he put it down. He said, "Right, let's get back to the real stuff." And so I got the other piece out again and I put it down. And as I thought, "Oh, hang on, that was the real stuff for me," you know. Yeah. And so for the first time I could say, "Okay, I think I know what you know." That was the direction I wanted to go in.
Okay, so what is it then about this piece that made you think you're in your early 20s, 23, and you realise that you've written something quite quickly that represents what you want to say, who you are? I mean, do you...
Yeah.
Okay, we're about to hear it in the music, I promise, we'll tell its own story. But what is it, you know, objectively about the music that made you go, you know, this is my music?
I just got excited by it. I think the thing was I really got excited about it, and there's lots of mathematics in the piece. Although I'm not expecting anybody to notice mathematics or even be counting, I don't want people to go, "Ah, there's a ratio." But that's just something for me internally, which helps the tension of the music to go. It's nothing more than that. But nonetheless, it excited me, and to get that balance between structuring things and using, as this particular piece does, lots of maths, with also just being excited.
What about the title? Because Siosophy suggests, I don't know, to my mind, like a confluence of maybe philosophy, something to do with sociology, something to do with some kind of knowledge. I mean, it's a nice word. What does it mean?
It means, it is a nice word. Well, that's largely why I called it Siosophy. That's a nice word. It actually means pretensions to knowledge, and so many of my title, I'm terrible at titling music, so... whatever I title things. I don't know, there's so many ridiculous titles of mine.
I think we're being sold quite a large red herring this evening, ladies and gentlemen. And I intend, after we've heard Siosophy, to interrogate this matter further, because I think Graham's music is about something, and I'm going to try and get him to say what it is after we hear Siosophy. So please welcome four pianists from the London Sinfonietta Academy Ensemble to play Graham Fitkin's Siosophy.
Thank you.
Graham Fitkin's Seosophy. Four pianists from the London Sinfonietta Academy Ensemble: Alex Wilson, Catherine Tinker, Antoine Francoise, and Kerry Owen. Now, Graham, there's something else about the way your music works, is how it's done. Your band, the people you write for. I mean, your music, Graham, is useful because people, you've written for people to play and people play it.
Yeah, there's nothing quite like playing your own music or being involved in a performance. And at the moment, I mean, I've been involved in performing my music in some way for a long time. But the present band of musicians I've got with me are just so tremendous, and it's such fun working with them. And it's actually, even when I'm commissioned by other small groups, it's really nice to work with those musicians and actually work with them on stuff. Because I'm writing for them now. I mean, if I'm writing for a saxophone in my band, I know it's Simon Harum or Nick Moss, and I know their sound, and so that helps me, and it helps them too.
And you're also writing then for the musical relationships, and then the kind of human relationships that are going to be had during the preparation of the performance. I mean, in Seosophy, all the music we've been listening tonight, the players are engaged in relating to one another, aren't they? Through the different rhythms, the things that the pianists literally have to do, way the saxophones have to sort of intertwine with one another.
Yeah.
They're doing things together.
They are, and they have to work, I mean, especially in that piece, they have to work very closely together because there are four hands on each piano and those hands are bashing into each other quite a lot. So, you have to get around, you have to accept that and get on with it and cause pain.
Cause pain.
Really. In that piece and in this, I mean, so far the two pieces we've heard are both monotimbral pieces, which is something
for set
of instruments, so just saxophones, just pianos, and so on. The next piece is slightly different.
Sinew.
It's about multi-timbral. It's got all sorts of different things, but it's about one line. It's just about a monody. It's just one line all the way through. So there's no accompaniment at all to the melody, if you like. It's just that the melody is very jagged.
Very jagged, and it's tough music. And the score says loud and relentless, right? Mm. And you even say in your performance indications to the players that, you know, this is going to be tough to play.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess what you're doing, somewhat statistically perhaps, is deliberately giving the players a hard time.
Right. Well, No, I don't think so. But I do like pushing it. I mean, in the first piece, you can see the saxophone players playing and moving the music across at the same time. Mm. My partner Ruth plays harp, and she plays a lot of my music now, and she swears every time she sees something from me, and then she manages to find a way around it magically. And so it's great when musicians find ways through things which they thought were impossible. And I mean, it's the same with a lot of my music. I do like that idea of stamina, starting somewhere and just keeping going relentlessly.
But then, is sinew then, does the title relate to, I mean, I guess I'm thinking a jagged melody, something strong, a single line like a sinew, or something else going on in sinew?
I suppose it's more about things being taken to the limit of something. If you imagine a rubber band or a tendon or something which is just about to snap, it's that thing where you're right on the edge of what's possible and it might just break. And I like that sort of dangerous area. And I think sinew sort of, that's why it's called sinew, you see. It's not a bad title.
That's a good one. It's better than Seosophy, to
yeah,
be fair. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Graham Fitkin's Sinew for six players.
Thank you.
Graham Fitkin's Sinew, played by six members of the London Sinfonietta Academy Ensemble, Harry Mikolas and Finlay Bain on clarinet and horn, Eloisa Fleur-Tom and Jenny Wilkinson, violin and viola, Alice Purton and Alex Wilson, cello and piano. That performance bringing us to the end of tonight's Proms Plus Portrait. Thanks to all of the musicians who've played this evening. Thanks to all of you for being here at the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall, the Royal College of Music, and a special thanks to Graham Fitkin, of course. Thank you.
In our Proms composer portrait, Graham Fitkin was in conversation with Tom Service. Now, just before tonight's edition of The Essay, news of a programme next week over on BBC Radio 4.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're going to have to back it up all the way. Let's go.
The Reef Lectures continue.
I think it was a
an illustration, a graphic and poorly illustration, of what a well-organised and highly motivated group of terrorists can achieve. And I think it made us realise that if they could do this in mainland America, anything was possible.
The former Director General of MI5, Eliza Manningham Buller, reflects on the lasting significance of 9/11. The Reith Lectures, 2011, over on BBC Radio 4, this Tuesday morning at 9 o'clock.
This, meanwhile, is BBC Radio 3, broadcasting on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Nick Luscombe is here with Wednesday's Late Junction in 15 minutes, that's at 11 o'clock. But first, the Radio 3 essay. Tonight and tomorrow, the programme is exploring the origins of the modern environmental movement and the figures whose work and ideas led up to the publication in 1962 of Silent Spring, Rachel Carson's stark warning about the devastating effects of pesticides as they spread through the food chain. This evening, in Before Silent Spring, the conservationist Kurt Meine reflects on the life of Aldo Leopold, the outdoorsman and forester who, shortly before his death in 1949, completed A Sand County Almanac, a book which has gone on to become both a classic of American nature writing and a key environmental manifesto.
As a conservationist, I have had my share of adventures and epiphanies over the years in marvelous exotic places around the world. In the wake of the Cold War, I worked alongside fellow conservationists in Eastern Europe as they emerged from the long night to bring environmental reform to their nascent democracies. I've crossed the vast wetlands and rice fields of Burma's Irrawaddy River Delta, studying the world's largest flying bird, the saurus crane. Along the remote shores of Hudson Bay in Canada, I've visited with Cree elders who are working with scientists and students to protect their vulnerable lands and waters. However, the most profound moment in my experience as a conservationist didn't occur during some adrenaline-fueled assignment in a far-flung location. It came, surprisingly, in the crypt-like underground vaults in a library in Madison, Wisconsin, in the U.S. I'd come to Madison in 1981 to begin graduate work in environmental studies at the University of Wisconsin. I was a child of the American environmental movement, having collected litter and cleaned streams as a schoolboy on the first Earth Day in 1970. I'd fallen in love with wild rivers and deep forests and open space. Yet, passionate though my interests were, I'd grown up only vaguely aware of the roots of ecological science and environmental thought. As I pursued graduate studies at the University of Wisconsin, I found myself combining my interests in the natural sciences, literature, and history. And this seemed to lead me inexorably to the work of the renowned Wisconsin-based wildlife ecologist, writer, and environmental philosopher Aldo Leopold, whom generations of readers had come to know through his classic 1949 book of essays, A Sand County Almanac. Its evocative prose and provocative ideas made the book required reading, not only for students, but for anyone interested in the broader questions involving the natural world and our role within it. My curiosity led me down into the subterranean world of the university archives in search of Leopold's extensive collection of papers. Within the collection was one particularly interesting box. I opened it to find fragmentary manuscripts and essays that were left unpublished at the time of Leopold's death, and that few, if any, other researchers had chanced upon since. Leafing through the papers, I read passage after passage of what to me was the literary equivalent of cold, clear, bracing spring water. Leopold seemed to have wrapped his mind around our historical moment. He wrote, "We end, I think, at what might be called the standard paradox of the 20th century. Our tools are better than we are, and grow better, faster than we do. They suffice to crack the atom, to command the tides, but they do not suffice for the oldest task in human history, to live on a piece of land without spoiling it." And Leopold communicated complex concepts in simple terms. The citizen who aspires to something more than milk and water conservation must first of all be aware of land and all its parts. He must feel for soil, water, plants, and animals, the same affectionate solicitude as he feels for friends and family. I was transfixed by these passages. At the time, the environmental movement that I'd grown up with was changing. It was going global, becoming more professional. It was spawning new and allegedly more radical expressions, even as it was triggering new waves of political backlash. Sitting in solitude in the archives, reading those elegantly simple expressions, I felt refreshed, revived, reconnected to a history that I never knew existed. Aldo Leopold was already a well-known figure in the history of American conservation and the environmental movement. He belonged to the first generation of trained American foresters and spent the first half of his career in the United States Forest Service. In that capacity, he pursued pioneering work in soil conservation, game protection, and wildland preservation. Through his efforts, the nation's first roadless wilderness reserve, the Gila Wilderness Area, was established in 1924 in the state of New Mexico. After moving to Wisconsin in the American Midwest, Leopold played a critical role in the development of the emerging field of wildlife management. In 1933, he published the first textbook in the field and became its first professor at the University of Wisconsin. There in the 1930s, he also helped define yet another new branch of conservation work, ecological restoration, a response to the astonishingly rapid loss of forests, wetlands, and prairie grasslands that had followed European settlement. He would remain at the University of Wisconsin for the rest of his life, training a new generation of conservation scientists, just as the emerging discipline of ecology was shifting the very foundation of natural resource management. Aldo Leopold, more perhaps than any other single individual, defined the need for and direction of that shift. And he did so especially in the posthumously published A Sand County Almanac, a volume whose influence continues to expand 6 decades after its publication. Aldo Leopold was always a prolific writer of professional prose, but in the late 1930s, as economic depression and ecological disaster played out on the American landscape, Leopold's writing took a distinct turn toward the lyrical. Over the next decade, Leopold developed this voice, the color and nuance in his prose deepening with each new essay. The result was a distinctive mix of humor and scientific insight, calm concern, and impassioned intellect. He wrote as an ornithologist, historian, hunter, and explorer, as an ecologist, fisherman, botanist, and landowner, as a teacher, and as a citizen. His subjects ranged widely across geographies and taxonomies. He wrote of songbirds and grizzly bears, of cranes and wolves, of trout and pines, of the small creatures that do their ecological jobs quickly and well. He took his readers out to some of the greatest wildlands of North America. He took them, almost unsuspectingly, into the mysteries of the local and commonplace. He took them even to places of ecological loss and damage. For the most important factor in the emergence of this new voice was the most personal. In 1935, Aldo Leopold acquired 80 acres of degraded Wisconsin farmland, not far from Madison, a piece of property that, like so much of the American Midwest at the time, had been, in Leopold's words, worn out and then abandoned by our bigger and better society. Sitting along the line of intersection between Wisconsin's tall grass prairies and northern forests, the land here had suffered from the previous century's assaults on both, the conversion of the prairie to agriculture, the nearly complete cutting over of the forest. The insights of ecology that Leopold explored through his writing were as relevant in places that had suffered under intense human use as they were in places that had been spared or protected from modern assaults. In the years that followed, Leopold and his family would bring those insights to bear on the ground. They planted tens of thousands of trees, restored native prairie species, monitored the changes in wildlife populations, and kept careful records of the natural history and seasonal changes across the recovering land. Leopold's descriptions of wildlife on the Sand County farm formed the first section of his evolving book. "To arrive too early in the marsh is an adventure in pure listening," he wrote. "The ear roams at will among the noises of the night, without let or hindrance from hand or eye. When you hear a mallard being audibly enthusiastic about his soup, you are free to picture a score guzzling among the duckweeds. When one widgeon squeals, you may postulate a squadron without fear of visual contradiction. And when a flock of bluebills, pitching pondward, tears the dark silk of heaven in one long rending nosedive, you catch your breath at the sound, but there is nothing to see except stars." As Leopold and his family worked to restore biological diversity and ecological health to that land, its transformation would in turn give ever greater depth to Leopold's evolving thinking on the relationship between humanity and the natural world. In another of those archival manuscript scraps, Leopold wrote, "There are two things that interest me, the relation of people to each other and the relation of people to land." As Leopold labored to gather his growing collection of essays into a coherent book, he sat at his desk to prepare an essay on the need for a new and healthier relationship between human and natural communities. The result was entitled The Land Ethic. "There is as yet," he wrote, "no ethic dealing with man's relation to land and to the animals and plants which grow upon it. The land relation is still strictly economic, entailing privileges but not obligations. The land ethic simply enlarges the boundaries of the community to include soils, waters, plants, and animals, or collectively, the land. It changes the role of Homo sapiens from conqueror of the land community to plain member and citizen of it." Rather than separating humans and nature, Leopold placed humans in nature and charged us to be responsible, respectful, informed members of an expanded community of life. With the land ethic, Leopold laid one of the essential cornerstones of modern environmental philosophy. And with it, he also found the keystone that his collection of essays needed to hold together. In April of 1948, Oxford University Press wrote to Leopold, declaring their interest in publishing his manuscript. But just a week later, Leopold was dead, victim of a heart attack while fighting a grass fire that had escaped from his neighbor's property. A Sand County Almanac was published the following year and began its own remarkable career. The book sold modestly over the next two decades. Then, as the modern environmental movement coalesced in the 1960s and early 1970s, it reappeared in new paperback editions, selling in the millions. A new generation of readers would find in Leopold's writing solid grounding for the growing movement. However, that same mass popularity would paradoxically sever the link between Leopold and his historical context. Because his writing and thinking was so far ahead of its time, readers tended to read him as a contemporary. The life and work that produced the book was of peripheral interest. His other writings, which traced so compellingly the growth of his thought and the development of conservation more generally, remained hidden underground in the archives. And regrettably so. As the environmental movement quickly expanded, it needed to understand both its continuity and its contrasts with the older conservation movement. It was the opportunity to do so through Leopold, so important in coming to understand my own interests and the changing state of global environmental affairs, that mesmerized me that day in the basement of that quiet library. The American writer Wendell Berry has written of Leopold, "Of all the conservationists who have preceded us, Leopold was the most radical, the most complete, and therefore the most needed. He was the most radical simply because he got nearest to the root of our problem, the lack of an appropriate standard by which to measure and guide our economic life. For Leopold, that standard was the health of the land and of ourselves, our communities, and our institutions within it. We speak of this now in terms of sustainability and ecosystem resilience, and we do so with reference to global systems as well as local landscapes. In our awareness of our environmental dilemmas, we have undoubtedly gained in sophistication, but I still find a necessary and bracing clarity in Leopold's words. We abuse land because we regard it as a commodity belonging to us, he wrote. When we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect. For those of us who see our complex ecosystems, communities, and economies woven together in ways that can hardly be called healthy or sustainable or resilient, such clarity means the world to us.
Tonight's essay was written and presented by Dr. Kurt Meine and produced in Wales by Jeremy Grange. The programme was first broadcast last October. Tomorrow night, the Nature writer Richard Mabey finds unexpected links between Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and the work of the English rural poet John Clare, who died a century earlier. That's the essay at the same time, 10:45, tomorrow night, here on BBC Radio 3.
What would you like to hear?
You pick the music. That's the message to the BBC Proms audience at London's Royal Albert Hall from the Budapest Festival Orchestra and conductor Ivan Fischer. It's an intriguing concert style that's proved very popular for them back home, and it forms the second of two Proms concerts Fischer and the Budapest Festival Orchestra are giving on Friday night. The first at 7 o'clock is more conventional, Liszt and Mahler rubbing shoulders in a programme of music with Hungarian connections. Friday night at the BBC Proms with the Budapest Festival Orchestra on BBC Radio 3.
Well, that's to come on Friday night, but meanwhile, tomorrow night, a programme by the Israel Philharmonic. They're visiting the Proms with their conductor for life, Zubin Mehta, and Gil Shaham as the soloist in the first half in Brooks' G minor violin concerto, tomorrow night from 7:30. This is BBC Radio 3. It's now just after 11 o'clock and time for Lake Junction with Nick Luscombe.
Brooklyn's UK based Shakedown, slickly fusing Afrobeat with 70s funk from the self-titled album released earlier this year. That track, Kumani Walk, and welcome to Late Junction with me, Nick Luscombe. Tonight's selection includes new music from Shadeen, Thundercat, and the Simon Sound, plus some great tracks from Tony Scott, Lulu Cortez, and Benny Maupin. And more sounds from New York now. From the album Chicada, this is Hazmat Modine featuring Natalie Merchant, Child of a Blind Man.
Gotta face a changing planet. Weather run out of balance. Wages, world warfare. Can we fix it with our love? Can we rise above? Gotta fix myself, can I manage? Ride those emotional of hours, the crash of days. Can I learn from my love? Can I rise above the rising? Finding recognition there, we take comfort.